Well, good afternoon, Juno. You're in tune with KTOO News. It's to 3 o'clock in the afternoon and time for Juno Afternoon. My guest today, Larry Johansson, will be here to talk about his new book, The Alexander 18. Ken Fix will come in to talk about The War of the Worlds. He's going to show it tonight at the Marie Drake Planetarium. Mark Conklin will come in to discuss a film, Memorial Day. He's produced it, and it's showing Wednesday at the Goldtown Theater. We'll have Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and a little bit more, all here on Juno Afternoon. Weather forecast looks like cloudy, highs around 62, southwest winds, 10 miles per hour. And then tonight, it stays cloudy with a little drizzle, a chance of rain, lows around 52, northwest winds 5 to 15. Wednesday, mostly cloudy, the high around 65, northwest winds 10.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Jocelyn Estes, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Police have arrested a suspect in the investigation of six fires set the night of July 14th on the Lacouturay Reservation in Wisconsin. The fires destroyed or damaged several structures, including a ceremonial lodge, powwow grounds, and the offices of the news organization Indian Country, as well as an RV that served as temporary housing for Indian Country CEO Paul DeMaine, who was away at the time. With Congress due to take a break in August, there is increased pressure on the House to pass an extension to the Violence Against Women Act of 1994. Supporters, including law enforcement and domestic violence organizations and faith-based groups, say it's a comprehensive and effective law. House Republicans have created a version that removes protection for LGBT, immigrant, and Native American women. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
The Senate passed an extension of the Violence Against Women Act with broad bipartisan support. The legislation would give tribal courts the power to prosecute non-natives who abuse native women. It also extends protections to the LGBT community and increases reporting requirements on college campuses. House Republicans say those new provisions are unnecessary, but New Hampshire Democratic Senator Gene Shaheen says they're vital to updating the law to meet contemporary needs facing vulnerable communities.
The fact is we have bipartisan legislation that passed the Senate. We know that in the House there is not bipartisan support for the House bill, and we're really calling on the House to pass this legislation.
Congress is scheduled to leave Washington at the end of this week for its summer break. Senators fear time is running short to pass the bill before lawmakers start campaigning full-time ahead of November's elections. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Legislation designed to address home ownership problems for Native Americans on tribal land is headed to President Obama for his signature. The bill unanimously passed the House in May and the Senate on the 17th of this month. Sponsor Representative Martin Heinrich, Democrat of New Mexico, says the new law will help with serious housing shortages in Indian Country. Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Ottone has more.
The HEARTH Act, which stands for Helping Expedite and Advance Responsible Tribal Home Ownership, will allow tribal governments to approve leases on Indian land directly instead of waiting for the Bureau of Indian Affairs to approve said leases. The BIA process can take anywhere from 6 months to 2 years. Patrick Goggles is Executive Director for Northern Arapaho Tribal Housing on the Wind River Reservation. He says there are at least 20 Arapaho tribal members who have been waiting to negotiate land with the BIA in order to build homes, and possibly more waiting.
Because the home site leasing process has taken that long, and to get that in place prior to actually going to a loan program for a loan guarantee has often been highly frustrating for tribal members, hence the reason you don't see a lot of members engaged in the homeownership activity.
Goggles says reducing wait times for lease approval will help tribal members on Wind River get better lease terms through federal agencies like the Veterans Administration, HUD, or Rural Development. The bill is expected to be signed by President Obama soon. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
Annually in July, the Veterans Administration hosts the American Indian Veterans Gourd Dance at the Raymond G. Murphy VA Medical Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Traditionally a warrior's dance among Southern Plains Indians, organizers say it brings healing, prayer, and protection to Native American veterans. The 5th annual VA American Indian Veterans Gourd Dance is coming up Saturday. For National Native News, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Sanosky Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 5 minutes and a half, almost 6 minutes after three. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore hosting today on Juno Afternoon. And my first guest is the author of a wonderful collection of short essays and photographs called The Alexander 18. Larry Johansson, 18 what?
18 wilderness areas as identified in definition by the Wilderness Act of 1964.
And these are all in the Alexander Archipelago?
They are, and there are 19 altogether in the Tongass, and I chose to identify 18 in the Alexander Archipelago, and part of the reason of the title jumping into it is using Alexander is I wanted to give them an identity beyond just Tongass. So many things are named Tongass.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought one of the shames of that was out there that these wilderness areas were not recognized. If you were to ask somebody to name the 18 wilderness areas in Alexander Archipelago, very few people could come up with maybe three or four.
I certainly could not before I read the book. There were places in there that I had never heard of. So.
Right, and that was part of the reason for writing the book was I felt that these areas that are really special and magnificent on its definition of wilderness, there's so many wilderness areas out there that really are, well, I hate to say it, they're not first-class wilderness areas like they are here in Alaska. And these 18 were, I've been to them all, and they all have a separate personality to them. And I think they are 18 of the finest examples of wilderness all across the country. And I wanted to give them an identity. And by calling them the Alexander 18, I think it's set aside as its own classification of mm-hmm. of wilderness.
So this the Alexander Archipelago starts up at Pleasant Island, I think is about the northernmost.
Yes.
Actually, that's outside the archipelago, I believe.
Yes,
isn't it? Yeah.
It is. And there is one wilderness area that could arguably be not part of the Alexander 18. That would be the Endicott River Wilderness Area. Mm. Technically,
You talk about the fact that it's more like, if you close your eyes, you think you're in southeast Alaska down there.
South Central
Alaska.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the reason why I included it in the 18 is because you could see the Alexander 18, the archipelago from the Endicott River. Now, there is a 19th in the Tongass that I wrestled with what to do with it because it's probably one of the most spectacular wilderness areas, maybe the most spectacular. It's the Russell Fjord Wilderness up by Yakutat.
So this is obviously your next book.
Well, you know, funny you should mention that. I just got back from a trip which friends and I took a Kennecott from Juneau to Yakutat mm-hmm. and spent 2 days photographing and experiencing the Russell Fjord Wilderness. And I have since, I was waiting for the show to announce that I've actually written the 19th chapter. It's on online at my website,
uh-huh.
the appendix, the 19th chapter. And so that now all 19 of the Tongass wilderness areas are represented.
Uh-huh.
And you can go to rowdydogimages.com and read it the 19th. And it probably is the most spectacular of the wilderness areas just because of the dynamics of the area, just tremendously beautiful. But, you know, they all are, and each one has a different personality. Just when I thought that I'd seen everything in my life. I've lived here in Alaska. My father was born here. I've had the luck to be in work, that occupation that took me to all these different places. And I thought, well, it's going to take a lot to show me something. But there were several wilderness areas that really threw me a curveball, so to speak.
Hmm. Got your attention.
Sure did.
Yeah. And what you said, the personality of a wilderness area. What are the components of the personality of a wilderness area?
Well, I think the way to explain this would be to take a look at how I approach the book. Wilderness areas have certain themes and issues that are common to all of them, but I identified the issues and themes and went to each wilderness area, and then took one of the themes that I felt the wilderness area best exemplified and used that as an illustration of a theme that ran through all the wilderness areas. And it worked really well to help bring up these themes, and by the nature of the diversity of the themes, the wilderness areas were quick to adopt one of the themes. As an example, wilderness themes, one of the most obvious ones is overcrowding, and there are a couple of different places that are primary attractions for visitors, and Misty Fjords being one, Tracy Arm being another. Is it possible to love a wilderness to death? Well, that's a very easy issue to come up with, and we examine that in Tracy Arm. Another one is, what are the characteristics of wilderness itself, and how do you define the wilderness? And Carter River down in Prince of Wales provided a good example of the different types of user groups that wilderness areas attract, people that use it, and so I explored that. Other areas that I looked at was the wildlife management, and Kutsunu or Admiralty Island lended itself very easily to that, and the geographic formations. One of the most surprising places that I went to, I knew about the caves in Prince of Wales Island, and I heard about those, but I wasn't really expecting the formations that were visible on the outside. And Coronation Island, we're under the corner and almost gassed. It looked like a fairyland. I had never seen anything like it. And the pictures, they look almost unnatural if you look at it. It's like somebody stretched the pictures, and it was a tremendously beautiful place and unusual. And so I talk about that. But each one of the areas lended itself to adapting one of the themes pretty well.
Do you mind if I read a section that I really liked?
No, go ahead.
This is when you were talking about Misty Fjords. From my perspective, a change came suddenly. At age 17, I'd hiked nearly every trail and climbed every mountain on the road system of Ketchikan. But on that day, I had discovered a trail that I had never been on before. It was an old trail, dilapidated, but definitely a trail. I was practically running along down it with the excitement of new discovery. All the excitement came to a gut-punching stop about a mile down the trail when I rounded a curve and came upon a holocaust. Where just a second ago I was in a darkened old-growth forest filled with life, I now stood in front of a bright open space. As far as I could see, there were cut-down trees, whitewashed stumps, and in the middle of it all, a giant mud puddle that had once been a mountain lake. I did not know how or why, but I knew an injustice had occurred here. Somehow the balance had shifted too far. That's good writing.
Well, thank you. I think it was a profound moment that when you're a young man and you're in a community when everybody is thinking one way, and suddenly you realize that, wait a minute, this isn't quite jiving with what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting story, and I cover that in Misty Fjords, is the political turmoil that people got involved in debating the issue, and I think it's since has evolved into something quite more complicated. It's not as stereotypical as environmentalist versus logging, which people tend to characterize the wilderness debate. It evolved into something much more, and the debate has changed, and I think the perceptions have changed. But at that time, it was very hotly politically debated issue. And part of the reason why I wrote the book was I had a front row seat. I'm one of very few people that can say they attended the D2 land selections and ANILCA hearings. The Congress actually came to Southeast Alaska, and as a young man, I sat in on the debate and listened to them talk about the issues. And that impressed me when senators were actually conducting official Senate hearings in Ketchikan. And from that perspective, with the 50 years of working, living in the wilderness, and for many years I worked for a small ship company called Cruise West, and part of my job was to develop ecotourism itineraries for these small adventure ships that would go to places that the big ships didn't go. So that occupation took me to a lot of small communities. I've been to almost every small community in Southeast. I've explored the likely destinations that a small ship for people would want to go to get away from where the mass tourism was happening. So part of my job was product development. So I had the background in that perspective. And I knew how to handle a camera. And it came upon me that I had the time, and probably nobody else had the perspective the history that I had to write the book. I almost felt it was my obligation to do so. And so this is what's come of it, is the Alexander 18.
Oh, I think it's a wonderful book. Are you doing a signing or anything like that?
Well, I'm working with Hearthside. It looks like I'm going to be doing one August the 11th, which is a Friday. It's downtown Hearthside after work for most people from 4:30 to 6. And then Sunday afternoon, the following, it'll be the 13th, I will be doing one in the afternoon from 12 to 1 on the 13th. But the books are available at Hearthside now and online as well on my website.
Yeah, you have a website, Rowdy Dog Images.
Rowdy Dog Images.
Right. It's a great name. Where did it come from?
Well, yes, it's true. I have a rowdy dog, and actually came upon when I had a split decision to make. We signed up for a website, and I couldn't figure out what to name it, and the dog was kept barking at me. So, are you a rowdy dog? I said, why
so there
not?
It was.
I never anticipated that it would grow into a brand name, I suppose is what it is now, but it is what it is.
Well, I think my advice to most of our listeners would be that you want to buy about 5 copies of this for Christmas presents this year, because this is going to be a book that I think anyone would love to spend a lot of time with. The photographs are marvelous, and the little essays have that same writing style as the example that I read a moment ago. So it's really a quality little piece. I think it's $25, and it would just make a wonderful Southeast Alaska gift for someone outside who isn't lucky enough to live here among us.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I look at it as the way I look at the writing. It's a 2.5-hour tour of the wilderness areas of Alaska.
Maybe a little longer than that, but it's a wonderful experience to read through. Thank you very much. Larry. Thanks for doing all of the work to bring the Alexander 18 to us, and now the 19th on your website as well.
Thank you.
Take a look at Rowdy Dog Images, folks. Here's a little literary transition, Garrison Keillor.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 24th of July, 2012. It's the birthday of Zelda Fitzgerald, born Zelda Sayre in Montgomery, Alabama, 1900, named for the gypsy heroine in the novel Zelda's Fortune, which was one of her mother's favorite books. She was the youngest of 5 children of an Alabama Supreme Court judge who she rebelled against. She snuck out at night, she smoked cigarettes, she bobbed her hair, and she wore a flesh-colored swimsuit so that people would imagine that she was swimming in the nude. She went off to dances and parties with officers from nearby Camp Sheridan, and it was there that she met a young officer named Scott Fitzgerald. They were both slight, they had blonde hair and light eyes. She wrote about him, he smelled like new goods. Being close to him with her face in the space between his ear and his collar was like being initiated into the subterranean reserves of a fine fabric store. Zelda Fitzgerald was a writer in her own right. She kept a journal, she wrote letters, and her husband borrowed from her ideas, sometimes copied writing from her verbatim. She once wrote a review of his book, The Beautiful and the Damned, in which she said, "In fact, Mr. Fitzgerald seems to believe that plagiarism begins at home." It's the birthday of the mystery novelist John D. MacDonald, born Sharon, Pennsylvania, 1916, famous for his novels such as The Deep Blue Goodbye and Nightmare in Pink, featuring Travis McGee, a beach bum detective who lives on a houseboat that he won in a poker game. John D. MacDonald, who said, "I am wary of a lot of things, such as time clocks, newspapers, mortgages, sermons, miracle fabrics, deodorants, pageants, progress, and manifest destiny." And it's the birthday of John Newton, born in London, 1725. He went to sea, became the captain of slave ships, carrying slaves between Africa and the sugar plantations of the West Indies. When he was 23, he had a spiritual conversion sailing back to England. He was almost drowned in a storm, but he prayed to God. The ship did not sink. And after that, he gave up drinking and gambling. He married the girl he loved. He was ordained as a minister. He gave up the slave trade entirely and became an abolitionist. He wrote a best-selling pamphlet, Thoughts Upon the Slave Trade. And about 20 years later, the slave trade was abolished in the British Empire. We know John Newton today as a writer of hymns, including this one, Amazing Grace, which is our poem for today. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace those fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear, the hour I first believed. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace has brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. The Lord has promised good to me, His word my hope secures. He will my shield and portion be, as long as life endures. Yes, when this flesh and heart shall fail, and mortal life shall cease, I shall possess within the veil a life of joy and peace. The earth shall soon dissolve like snow, the sun forbear to shine, but God, who called me here below, will be forever mine." Wrote John Newton. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses improve what potential customers find online in search engines and review sites. Learn more at Reputation.com. Produced by Nick Vetter, written by Betsy Alistair. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
24 minutes after 3, my next guest is bringing a very exciting film to Juneau. Ken Fix is here from the Planetarium. Ken, what are we going to see this time?
Thanks, Pat, for having me again. And tonight's movie at the Planetarium is going to be The War of the Worlds from 1953 with Gene Barry and Anne Robinson.
Okay, and this actually was not originally a movie. It started out as a radio show.
Well, it started out as a book written by H.G. Wells, and it came out, it was serialized in the Saturday Review in London in 1896, and it told of an alien invasion and Martians that had attacked London with these tripod machines and a heat ray and some deadly smoke that they were spilling out. And the people at the time read it, and it was actually a very good story for the time. And in 1938, the night before Halloween, it was October 30th, Orson Welles, as part of his Mercury Theater broadcasting on CBS, created this War of the Worlds dramatization. But in this case, instead of having it be London, they focused on a town in New Jersey where the Martians had landed. In this case, it's called Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and they picked it by just sticking a pin in the map, and that's kind of where it went. So they picked that. The radio dramatization was extremely effective, so much so that people just tuning in had not heard the disclaimer at the beginning of the show that this was just a radio dramatization, a play, and they missed it because they were listening to the Chase and Sanborn Hour on a different radio station. Most of them came in about 10 minutes into it, and the way it was constructed was it had music with, like, interruption breaks from news broadcasts, and they actually, people were listening and thought that this was real. Of course, today it's very improbable that something like this would occur because we have several different ways for media to travel. We not only have radio, we've got television, we've got the internet. Information can travel at the click of a mouse or a text message. People can send photos in seconds. So it'd be very easy to debunk something like this today and say, oh, well, this really isn't happening. But back in the time when we only had radio for sort of an instantaneous form of entertainment, these people tuned in and they thought that this was real.
Here's what it sounded like.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Professor Pearson and myself made the 11 miles from Princeton in 10 minutes. Well, I hardly know where to begin. To paint for you a word picture of a strange scene before my eyes, but something out of a modern Arabian night. Well, I just got here. I haven't had a chance to look around yet. I guess that's it. Yes, I guess that's the thing directly in front of me, half buried in a vast pit. Must have struck with terrific force. The ground is covered with splinters of a tree. It must have struck on its way down, but I can see the object itself doesn't look very much like a meteor, at least not the meteors I've seen. It looks more like a huge cylinder. Has a diameter of, what would you say, Professor Pearson?
What's that?
What would you say, what's the diameter of this?
About 30 yards.
About 30 yards. The metal on the sheath is, well, I've never seen anything like it. The color is sort of yellowish-white. It's curious. Spectators now are pressing close to the object in spite of the efforts of the police to keep them back. Getting in front of my line of vision. Would you mind standing one side, please? While the police are pushing the crowd back. Here's Mr. Wilmot, owner of the barn here. He may have some interesting facts to add. Mr. Wilmot, would you please tell the radio audience as much as you remember of this rather unusual visitor that dropped in your backyard? A step closer, please. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mr. Wilmot.
Well, I was listening to the radio.
Closer and louder, please.
Pardon me?
Louder, please, closer.
Yes. I was listening to the radio and kind of drowsing. A professor fellow was talking about Mars, so I was half chosen and half...
Yes, yes, Mr. Wilmot, and then what happened?
Well, as I was saying, I was listening to the radio kind of halfway...
Yes, Mr. Wilmot, and then you saw something.
Well, not first off. I heard something.
And what did you hear?
A hissing sound like this. Kind of like a 4th of July rocket.
Yes, then what?
I turned my head out the window and would have sworn I was asleep and dreaming.
Yes?
I seen a kind of greenish streak and then zingo. Something smacked the ground, knocked me clear out of my chair.
Well, were you frightened, Mr. Wilmot?
Well, I ain't quite sure. I reckon I was kind of riled.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wilmot. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you want me to tell
you? No, that's quite all right. That's plenty. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard Mr. Wilmot, owner of the farm, where this thing has fallen.
Well, Ken, that was the radio broadcast, or at least a little chunk of it, about 2 minutes long, that caused the controversy of this program on the air. I
Right.
And that led to a real panic in New Jersey.
It did. Several locations up and down the East Coast, actually. And several of the improbabilities in the radio broadcast was at the beginning they're talking to an astronomer at the observatory, and they say, well, we've seen these explosions on Mars. But then 10 minutes later, they're at this site in New Jersey, and it's like people just didn't equate to how in the world did these guys get from here to here in just 10 minutes. And, you know, all these police are assembled and everything. And, of course, like 12 minutes later into the drama, the entire National Guard from New Jersey is decimated. And, you know, these things are advancing on New York. And it's like, really, these things can happen that fast? Also, people missed that there were three different identifications in the program, aside from the one at the beginning, that said this was just a dramatization. It wasn't real. But the reactions of people were just incredible. Several mm-hmm. people thought that this was the real deal, and I'm just going to read a couple of quotes off of this. Many listeners who sought more information and were confused by the reports that they'd heard, and then they were indignant when they learned that the fiction, you know, was all the cause of their alarm. In San Francisco, one guy said, my God, where can I volunteer my services? We got to stop this thing. In St. Louis, the men and women clustered in the streets of a residential area to discuss what they should do in the face of this war. And another one drove 15 miles away to a newspaper office to verify the radio report. Of course, again, this wouldn't happen these days due to the vast flow of information that we have now. Here's one reaction in New Orleans was, the general impression prevailed that New Jersey had been devastated by invaders, but few inquiries were received. Well, I guess New Orleans really didn't care what happened in New Jersey. So that was kind of funny. But
it was definitely
Went to the point of, you know, several people were shooting at a water tower in one neighborhood because they thought it was a Martian war machine, despite the fact that it had been there for months. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, come on.
When did this air? What year was this?
This was October 30th of 1938. This was their Halloween show. And in fact, at the end of it, they came and said, this was our attempt to jump out and say boo to you from behind the bushes.
Right.
And it really caused a lot of shakeup. The FCC had been established 4 years previous. And the only thing that really came out of this was that you could no longer use the phrase, we interrupt this broadcast to bring you whatever it was, mm-hmm. unless it was an actual emergency. So you could not use it in a dramatization anymore. You could also not use the words flash or bulletin unless it was real.
Mm-hmm.
So those things came out of the 1938 broadcast. But other than about 2,000 protest letters and hundreds of calls to state and local authorities, nothing really came about after this, just a few minor changes. But the radio program went down in infamy as, you know, kind of one of the biggest hoaxes perpetrated on the listening public.
And for those of us students of broadcast drama, it came down in my mind as one of the best radio dramas anybody ever put on the air.
I think another reason for its effectiveness was it was less than 18 months after the explosion of the Hindenburg in Lakehurst, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So, and people had gathered around the radio to receive their information. That's where they got their news pretty much every evening, newspaper and radio. And having heard that Lakehurst broadcast as the Hindenburg burst into flames and people had been killed, this sounded extremely real. In fact, the Orson Welles and his company patterned those radio broadcasts off of the Lakehurst broadcast because they thought it would have more effect. So
certainly
that's,
did.
That was pretty cool. But,
so what are we going to do tonight?
Tonight we're running the 1953 version of The War of the Worlds with Gene Barry and Ann Robinson.
Okay.
This is a classic. This is one of the best movies for science fiction to ever come out of the 50s or 60s. It's extremely effective even today. And you got to realize that everything that you're going to see is all done without the aid of any digital effects or anything like that. There's a lot of spaceships on wires, but you know, everything was basically done in camera with optical effects. And they actually shot several scenes at the beginning of production in Arizona, where a National Guard group was having military maneuvers, because you'll see the actors running amongst the vehicles at the time. You know, there's tanks, there's Jeeps, there's, you know, other military hardware that's supposedly pulling out in the wake of this devastation from these three Martian war machines that are in there. And that's the actual actors there. It's not any, you know, stunt guys or special effects or whatever have you. Those were the actual people that were, you know, in the movie at the time, and they took advantage of these military maneuvers in order to shoot this segment. So that was kind of interesting what I found out about that. And, of course, there's been another version that's come out in 1988. There was a TV series that was based on War of the Worlds. And also in 2005, there was a movie with Tom Cruise that the Martians actually had the tripod-shaped war machines that they would have had in the H.G. Wells book, but they're a little bit more updated. And then, of course, there's Independence Day, which is also patterned after War of the Worlds, but in this case, instead of bacteria killing the aliens, it's a computer virus that they upload into the mothership that, you know, were able to defeat them and take them down. So. But, no, War of the Worlds is actually a very terrific movie. It won an Academy Award for special effects. Instead of having the invasion based in London, of course, they moved it to Los Angeles for the centerpiece. It was much easier to shoot everything right there. It actually closed off streets during pre-production so that they could show a vacant Los Angeles as if everybody had retreated to the hills, which actually happens towards the end of the movie.
Wow. So this starts tonight at what time?
6:30.
6:30.
And it's about a 90-minute film. As people are filtering in, I'll be playing some segments off the radio broadcast and also showing a few pre-production photos of how they did the spaceships and the one Martian that you get to see in there, just so if there's any little kids, they're not too scared because they'll know it's just something that was made out of chicken wire and latex. And you know, but there's only one Martian that's in there, and you actually get a very brief look at him, and that's pretty much it. There's also a classic scene in there where the Martian puts his hand on Anne Robinson's back, and she has a really frightened, scared look on her face. Well, Steven Spielberg took that and actually used that in the movie E.T., because there's a scene in there where Elliot's brother says, what's going on here? And Elliot says, I don't know, something wild. And E.T. from behind puts his hand on his shoulder the same way that the Martian does to Anne Robinson in War of the Worlds. But that was his nod to War of the Worlds that he did for E.T.
Yeah, wonderful. 6:30 tonight at the Planetarium, which is located for
We are on Glacier Highway. If you're coming from downtown or just past where the Blockbuster is on the left-hand side before the fencing starts for the soccer fields and the pool. So we'll be on the left-hand side. If you're coming from where the breakwater is and you make the left turn and then the right onto Glacier, it's just as soon as the fences end. And if you went to the Blockbuster, you went too far.
Okay, good.
But yeah, from 6:30 to 8. Oh, yeah.
And with a little explanation to keep the kids from getting too frightened.
And some popcorn will be available for people that want to buy some. But it's a very relaxed atmosphere. Bring lawn chairs, bring blankets, whatever. We're just glad to have you. And this is the middle of the summer schedule. Next month we'll be running When Worlds Collide.
Okay. Ken Fix, thank you so much. Thanks for bringing these movies to us.
Thanks again, Pat.
skinny spaceman. Can't you see that I'm on the lam? Come on, you flying saucer, won't you make me an offer? The book is right, the time is right.
Well, a song called I'd Go, talking about the alien, the willingness to join the aliens coming down to invade. So the reason for the song is because tonight Ken Fix is going to be showing War of the Worlds at the Planetarium, 6:30. Drop by. It's a free show. The popcorn does cost, but it's not, you know, not that much. And another kind of movie is the subject of my next guest. The producer of Memorial Day is here with me. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you're showing this Wednesday night at the Goldtown?
Yep, tomorrow night at the Goldtown Theater at 7 o'clock. We're going to show the film, and then I'm going to be sticking around afterwards for a little Q&A.
Oh, good. So you were the screenwriter on the film?
I was the screenwriter on the film, yep.
Okay. How does a film like this... this is not a big studio production.
No.
This is a small company. So how does a film like this get... It's funding and get to the point where it actually comes to the screen.
Yeah, well, the story, the story of the making of this film is almost as interesting as the story in the film. I don't think there's any. Yeah, I think any all independent films are made in different ways, financed in different ways. You know, there's really no handbook, and this was a pretty unlikely story. How this film, which 3 years ago to this date was nothing, is now out there, and it's been a top 100 bestseller on Amazon since it came out, and won some film festival awards. But basically, it was the brainchild of a couple of guys in a little town in Minnesota called La Center. And these were childhood friends, and one was an ex-Marine, and the other owns a hunting lodge down there. Hmm. And they just had this idea about, you know, this movie where a boy finds his grandfather's World War II footlocker. And, you know, I think we all know someone who won't talk about the war. You know, we all have friends or family. Maybe we are one of those people. And they wanted to, you know, have a nice story where the two of them reach a deal, and the grandfather's going to tell stories behind three of the objects in the footlocker that the boy finds. And, you know, you're going to flash back to World War II, and you're going to see the stories behind these three objects, but you're also going to flash forward because this boy ends up going to Iraq through the Minnesota National Guard, and it's just about how their experiences kind of parallel each other, even though the conflicts are very different, the landscapes are very different. So, you know, it started with these two guys with this idea. They approached a director named Sam Fisher, who works in my building, and they said, you know, we think we can do this. And at that point, I was hired to write it. And, you know, from the first meeting, the year after that, a script is done and it's shooting. A year after that, it's finished editing. And a year after that, it's on Amazon. So it's a pretty amazing story.
Right. So what had you written? What kinds of things had you done before? Had you done film before?
I'd done lots of film before. I was, you know, your classic advertising copywriter who's always writing a script. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a hobby of mine for 10 to 15 years. And my material was always couldn't be more different than this film. You know, I'd never wrote war movies. I was the guy writing the quirky romantic comedies, mm-hmm. And entering contests. And, you know, I had a contest win and I had something optioned. Nothing, you know, everything got me a little bit closer, but nothing had quite broken through. And I think this was probably the seventh script that I'd written. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I heard a real screenwriter. Well, I guess maybe I'm a real screenwriter now, but I heard a Hollywood screenwriter, yeah, let's say. Once say that you need to put yourself in a position to take advantage of luck.
There you go.
And I think that's pretty much what happened.
How'd you get picked up by these guys?
By the production company?
Yeah.
I was just fortunate to meet Sam Fisher, the director, who worked in Hollywood for 20 years on feature film and episodic television, as starting, I think, as a gaffer, then a cinematographer, worked his way up to being a cinematographer. He moved out of Hollywood because he said he wanted to get out of the machine, mm-hmm. You know, didn't like the culture. It's a culture I've never really wanted to be a part of either. You know, I just kind of want to live in my little nice Midwestern town. And He moved for a better lifestyle, and we ended up working together on commercial shoots.
Mm-hmm.
I met him on the shoot for a boating catalog where I was standing with my thumb in the mouth of a bass for this pontoon catalog, and he was there doing the video, and that's how we struck up our friendship. We ended up moving into the same building, and this just came along.
Yeah. So the film then went into production, and you said they did all of the shooting in a year. Is that from shoot to edit? First shot
from
to edit?
Shoot to edit was a yeah. From nothing to shooting 1 year, from shooting to finished edit another year.
Okay, but this is again only possible now if you're doing it in video because of the ease of editing. Am I right?
To some extent, this kind of movie, for its funding, I don't think ever would have been made if we couldn't use it. It uses very high end digital,
mm-hmm.
A camera called the Red, which really shoots better than film. You know, digital is now surpassing film.
Mm-hmm.
But the ease of not having to deal with film and film developing certainly helps quite a bit.
Yeah, it cuts out an entire industry.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It does.
Having produced a 16-millimeter film years ago,
yeah.
I know exactly what it cut out.
Yes,
and it was
sure
the hardest
do.
Part of the whole thing.
Yep.
We were trying to color match the Aurora, and you can't do that. Anyway.
Right.
So does video taping, actually digitizing now, does that give you the ability to do something different than you would do with film? I know it makes it easier. I'm wondering if there's an advantage other than ease.
Other than ease?
Maybe I'm asking the wrong person. Maybe I shouldn't be talking to your cameraman.
Well, I'm sure he would be able to tell you much more. I knew this was a good educational experience for me, I actually sat in on as much as I could of that side of things.
Uh-huh.
There was one day where I sat in the room at a place called Pixel Farm in Minneapolis where they were color correcting.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought about the process that goes into that. And I imagine with digital, that's a much easier thing to do where you've got, but you're going frame by frame and you're adjusting tints and making things look more like daylight than they would have otherwise. I think digital helps all of that. Plus, when you shoot on something like the Red camera, the resolution is so strong that if you wanted to reframe a shot a little bit differently than you did, you can zoom in quite a bit. And still maintain
and
the same
still
definition.
Caught because of the pixel count.
Which is kind of a dangerous thing in a way. I mean, it could make you a little bit lazy as a cameraman about how you might frame a shot because you know that you've got a little bit of wiggle room there. So,
when you're writing on a film script, how much of the visual are you creating versus how much of the visual gets created by the guy who's pushing the button on the camera?
That's a really good question. I mean, when you're writing a script, you are not supposed to direct. You're not supposed to write close-up on, pan along. But there are tricks to getting that vision that you have on the page without the director feeling like you're doing his or her job. And there was actually a funny instance of this where I'm driving with Sam Fisher, again, the director, and we're talking about the last scene of the film, which I'll try to talk about without spoiling it.
No spoilers.
But he said, "Yeah,
I don't want to sit over here and say spoiler alert, spoiler
right,
alert."
Right. But he said, "Yeah, we were talking about how that last scene really seems to move people. We had done some screenings, people had watched it, and we were getting a really good emotional reaction to this last scene." And he said, "I don't know how I got the idea to shoot it the way I did, where everything's very low, and you just see, you don't see anyone's faces, and then you see the glass." This sounds very mysterious, doesn't it?
Mm.
And and I'm thinking, well, because I wrote it that way.
That's
right. If you write sweat pours down the glass, then it's telling the director that's a close up.
Right.
So you can kind of manipulate the director a little bit.
Ah, okay. Yeah. If I run into Sam, I won't tell him you did that to him.
Yeah, I didn't bring it up in the car.
Okay, good. Okay, so you had a director, you had the writer. How many people does it take to make a small production like this?
Oh, boy.
So, I mean, at the end of feature films, the credits go on. I'm one of those guys who sits in the theater and drives the cleanup crew nuts because I watch to the end of the credits.
You're the only one. Yeah.
No, usually, yes. My wife and I are sitting there together. Anyway, so how many people does it take to make a film like this? How many did it take?
Even a little film like this, it took, I'd guess between 100 and 200 people.
Really?
Probably more than that when you figure in, because this movie is unique in that because it has the military angle. There are a lot of real Minnesota National Guard soldiers were involved. You know, as background, some of them got speaking roles, a lot of advisors to make sure we got everything right from the military standpoint. So in a sense, there might have been a few more people than normal, but, you know, even on a little production like this, which still looks like a big movie, there you got hundreds of people. That you'll be sitting in the theater a long time for that scrolling at the end.
And you have all of these odd names that show up on the screen in the credits.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked in film a little bit, but I have no idea what some of those people do or why they're called that.
Yes.
Is there a guide?
I'm sure there is somewhere. You're probably thinking Best Boy and Gaffer.
Those are pretty obvious, but
yeah.
there's some weird stuff. You know, there's like kind of a lot of it now is digital. Things mm-hmm. that have to be done, and I'm amazed when they do a science fiction film at the number of artists that are involved in everything.
Oh.
I mean, it's like, you know, the screen has to get wide in order to put all those names.
Yes.
Yeah. Is there any? Did you guys have to do any digital work?
We did have
like
to do a little digital work. We shot this movie, even though it takes place in Minnesota, Belgium, Holland, and Anbar Province, Iraq. It was all shot in Minnesota. The Hunt Lodge that Jeff Traxler, the executive producer, owned, served as all of our European locations. When they first came to me and they said they wanted to shoot Iraq in Minnesota, I didn't know these guys. I thought they might be clinically insane. I thought, of all the places to try to shoot, the desert, you're picking Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Alaska would be even more outrageous. But they drove me and...
I can take you to sand dunes if you need me to.
Okay. Well, the next war movie's going to be here.
There you go.
But we drove out to a quarry outside of Mankato, Minnesota, that, you know, when we had a real Marine there, and he said, yeah, I've been to Anbar Province, and this is what it looks like. So we shot all that stuff there, but then, of course, you do have some tree line in the background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you saw the first cuts, you saw a lot of... That stuff had to be eliminated digitally. But there's very, very little, you know. It's done to be very down-to-earth and authentic. You know, a couple windows shattering were added, some of that tree line. But for the most part, it was all there. Not a lot of trickery going on.
Mm-hmm. When there's a point where, on every one of these projects, I'm sure, where you feel that it's not going to happen, that the combination of forces that are working against finishing the production are so huge. Did that happen here?
Oh, many times.
Okay.
Many times. You know, it happened on the investment end when we had a script, and then it was time to get out in front of people and say, hey, who wants in?
Yeah.
And a little bit of marketing advice for anyone, you know, thinking of raising money for a film, although there are tools now like Kickstarter and other things like that, but the pitch of saying, you know, we're going to make this movie and it's going to be huge, that didn't really work. When Jeff Traxler went back to people and said, who wants to go on an adventure? We're going to make a movie and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Then his friends, you know, were chipping in, and then they were able to raise money. But every step along the way, you think it's not going to happen. You think you're not going to get the cast. You think, you know, then when it's all done and you're really excited about it, you're looking for a distributor. And I was a couple steps removed from that process, but there's that whole thing, too. Is anyone going to pick this up? And in what sense are they going to pick it up? You know, what kind of distribution are you going to get? So, yeah, there's always doubts along the way. And it's, you know, it's a feat to get to the point where you do have actual distribution on something like this. So.
Who did pick it up, and how is it being distributed?
It was picked up by there's a domestic distributor named Image Entertainment.
Okay.
And there's a foreign distributor. Their name is Screen Media.
Okay.
The foreign side is so convoluted, it's hard to even explain. But basically, they have the rights to sell it to individual countries. So they'll go, you know, sell the rights to Germany for X amount of money. The domestic side is a little easier to understand because it's basically there's ancillary distribution, which is everything but a theater, but a big mm-hmm. theatrical run, and then there's theatrical. And what we got is the distributor said, we want to do the ancillary rights. We want to do the streaming, you know, get it on iTunes, get it on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this movie came out. And it's on Amazon. It's in Redbox. Sells at Walmart, most Walmarts, not all Walmarts.
How did Goldtown get it?
Goldtown got it. It's a strange connection. Pat Minnick, who actually does a show mm-hmm. here once a month, is a good college friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Actually lived
okay.
in Ireland together. We studied abroad together. And through the wonders of Facebook, he said, you know, I've been following all of your posts on this film, and we have this great theater in Juneau, and he knows that I've been here twice before, and I absolutely love it. And he said, why don't you, you know, see if the Gold Town will give you a screening. And I said, great, we're doing everything we can on the theatrical end to get it out there. And it was also, you know, a good reason to take my 9-year-old son up here and show him Southeast Alaska.
So when did you come?
Just got here. Jeez, was it just yesterday?
Huh?
Yes, it was just late last night.
Yeah, the place
night.
Will grow on you real fast.
Yeah, yeah.
So enjoy the rest of the time that you're here. How long are you staying?
We're here for about another week.
Oh, okay, good.
Yep.
Well, you got plenty of time to see Southeast Alaska then, in between showings. And the showing that we need to make sure everybody understands is Wednesday night.
Yep.
It's at the Gold Town Theater time.
7 o'clock.
7 p.m., okay.
And then I was just talking to Colette at the theater. I think it's August 5th.
Okay.
It has another run at 2 and 7.
But unfortunately, this is the one that you will be at, not
right.
not the August 5th.
So it's, maybe it's really not worth it if you can't talk to the screenwriter.
So, right. I mean, if you get a chance to talk to the dude who made the movie. Right.
Right.
So Wednesday night, 7 o'clock at the Gold Town Theater. The movie is called Memorial Day. The screenwriter is Mark Conklin. He'll be there for a Q&A afterwards. Mark, thank you so much for coming down to the studio and telling us about all this.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Recognize these great horned owls? We've been following them since last winter when the adults started nesting. We watched the two owlets hatch early in spring, high in a tall cottonwood tree. Throughout the spring, their fierce hunter parents airlifted in meal after meal, everything from delectable ducks to smelly skunks. At 4.5 months old, the young owls must fend for themselves much of the time. Room service is not what it used to be. But still, we see them perched near their parents. The young birds continue to learn valuable lessons by watching the adults hunt. The young owls' first hunting forays were clumsy. Early on, they caught no more than large insects, but now they've graduated to mice. The owlets must learn quickly about hazards, like not hunting too close to the nearby country road, where cars and trucks pose a deadly threat. Collisions with vehicles kill many owls. They'll stay with their parents into the fall. It takes a long time to raise a great horned owl to independent adulthood. I'm Mary McCann. If you'd like to see a very funny video of some young owls, visit our website, birdnote.org.
Today's broadcast is supported by the Silver Bow Bakery, offering 4 different made-to-order salads each day for the summer season. The Silver Bow Bakery, located downtown on 2nd Street.
About 2 minutes before 4 o'clock, all things considered, coming up on tomorrow's program, Byron McGillivray and Laura Haywood will drop in to talk about the JLO Broadway Splash Workshop performance, Thursday night's Old Hollywood Gala at the Rendezvous. Mike Sicarius will come in to talk about Recording Frogs, and Brian Wallace will talk about the donation of his father's drawings to the Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation. We'll hear that, Writer's Almanac, music, and a whole bunch more tomorrow when Jeff is back with Juneau Afternoon. This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and KTOO also broadcasts in the area on a set of translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, it's K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM, 88.1 MHz. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you can hear KTOO on K210AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can also hear KTOO on JCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. Our sister stations KRNN and KXLL are on 872 and 873, and we stream continuously at www.ktoo.org.